mí. Rest in día tu que le no bon a mí. No bon a mí. Up to what you bought it'll be messy, messy. You can elect him to the office, he begs of you. District attorney, he can do it, he'll promise you. Give him a chance to do his duty, please do. Don't vote on me for the vote. Let the bells ring. Let the band sing. Here he is to give himself to you. Let the bells ring. Let the band sing. Preston is the man for you. Preston is the man for you.
Philpott Medical Center is a fully accredited acute care hospital featuring a 15-room surgical pediatric unit, a 31-room medical unit, an 8-bed intensive care unit, and an emergency department with 7 private exam rooms and 2 large trauma rooms. Our surgery center has 4 OR suites, a cysto room, and a 9-bed outpatient center. We use the BIS Anesthesia Brain Monitor, a sophisticated medical device that safely monitors the effects of anesthesia and sedation during surgery. The imaging, laboratory, and cardiopulmonary diagnostic equipment is state-of-the-art and the finest available in the area today. The cardiac cath lab has expanded our capabilities for early diagnosis and treatment of heart disease. We have a full-service rehab department and Wellness Plus, the only full-service fitness center in Evangeline Parish. Our professional team is working hard to make this great community even better. Come on home to Philpott Medical Center.
Be sure the dormy, be shadows on me. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Preston Oakland. Thank you for listening. And before I go into the subject matter of my program for today, I again urge and invite those of you who are kind enough to listen and who may have any comments to make about the program, or who may wish to voice any likes or dislikes about it, or who may have any suggestions to make, may do so by ringing me at my number at 363-1492. That's 363-1492, the Columbus number. Easy for you to remember, or you may drop me a line. You may drop me a line at 2719 Opelousas Road, Ville Platte, Louisiana. That's 2719 Opelousas Road, Ville Platte, Louisiana. Or you may call the radio station at 363-2124. That's 363-2124. You give them the message and they'll see to it that I receive it. And I give you my assurance that I am going to do my level best to accommodate you. Now, today my program concerns a court case that occurred about half a century ago, 1960 to be specific. I had been out of law school about a year and I was beginning to feel my oats. I had determined, for better or for worse, that I wanted to become a country trial lawyer. I was developing a feel for it, and I found myself liking to be on the inside of the courtroom. Now, it isn't for all lawyers, and many of them make a darn good living with an office practice, and I suppose it is much easier on the nerves. But I wanted some of each of those two worlds. I wanted an active trial practice and an office practice as well, and I was trying to learn how to balance the two. Judge Frugier, who had appointed me to my first jury trial immediately upon my completion of law school and my entering the practice of law in February of 1959, had moved to the newly created Third Circuit Court of Appeal in Lake Charles. It was an interesting move. The new Court of Appeal was composed of 5 appellate judges and covered an area of 7 parishes, including the heavily populated parishes of Lafayette, Calcasieu, Rapides, and the Imperial Parish of St. Landry, whose capitals included the big cities of Lafayette, Lake Charles, and Alexandria. Now, notwithstanding that configuration and the logic that this court should be dominated by judges of those heavily populated parishes, out of the five judges, now incidentally, today that number has increased to 12 judges, but two were from Ville Platte, and that was Judges J. Cleveland Frugier and Al Tate. It was amazing and defied logic that the small and sparsely populated parish of Evangeline would contribute 40% of the court. That is two of the five judges. And I think that the only way it can be explained is that the masterful and most skilled politicians resided in Evangeline Parish, a tribute to our parish that was only 50 years old at the time of the creation of the new court. The Imperial Parish had been there for an eternity. Since Louisiana was admitted to statehood as the 18th state in 1812, and originally stretched from the Sabine River on the west to the Atchafalaya on the east, from a few miles this side of the count in Rapides Parish to the Gulf of Mexico, embracing 14 parishes, that is 14 present parishes, including Lafayette, Calcasieu, and Evangeline. But the Imperial Parish did not get a judge on that Court of Appeal until about 2 years ago. Evangeline, on the other hand, which was carved out of the Imperial Parish in 1911, about 100 years ago, after the Imperial Parish became a parish, composing roughly one-third of the entire state, got not only one of the two judges on that court half a century ago. Lafayette, ladies and gentlemen, did not get one judge on that new Court of Appeal. Not only did Ville Platte get two of the five judges on the new court, but Judge Frugier was Al Tate's uncle and his parent, the only court in Louisiana which had this combination and which will probably ever have this combination. Ville Platte has had at least one judge on that court continuously since its creation. When Judge Frugier vacated the bench of the 13th Judicial District Court in Evangeline Parish, it opened the door for the first district judge election. Judge Frugier had been appointed the first district judge by the Kingfish, that is Governor Hewitt Pierce Sloan, and had never been challenged. The contenders for this post were an older lawyer named Roland B. Reed and Rosamond J. Vidrine, a much younger lawyer and law partner of the district attorney, L.O. Fuselier. Well, Vidrine had the powers on his side, and he easily won the election. When he ascended the bench in 1960, he became Judge Joe Orr Vidrine instead of his lawyer name of Rosamond Joe Vidrine. At this time, Milo Correll, who later became state representative and district judge, made history, not only in Evangeline Parish, but throughout the whole state of Louisiana. Correll, who had never gone to law school one day in his life, read law on his own, which was at that time permissible in Louisiana. He had a fellow from Lafayette named Rick Sabuto, who interestingly enough had once lived in Ville Platte and had worked at Cabot, renting a room from Mr. and Mrs. Kossuth Fontenot, who lived on High School Drive across the street from Ville Platte High School, and then became a court reporter after he moved back from Lafayette. He also read law on his own, never attending law school, just like Milo Correll did. He and Milo took the bar at the same time, and both passed it and got admitted to the bar. Also of interest is the fact that both of them became district judges later on, Rick in Lafayette and Milo in Evangeline. They were the last two persons in Louisiana to accomplish this because it became prohibited after Dave passed. So Milo and Richard will go down in the annals of Louisiana history as being the last two to accomplish this. Both of them are now deceased. Well, as you would have it, Milo and I became good friends, professionally, philosophically, personally, and politically. We enjoyed each other's company. I had received my law license approximately 1 year before he did, and had a little more experience than he, but not enough to make much difference. I shared whatever I knew with him, and we did some cases together. So beginning January 1st, 1960, the new judge, the Honorable Joe R. Vedrine, took over the helm as our new judicial father, replacing Judge J. Cleveland Trujillo. L.O. Fuselier was district attorney, and Joe V. Green, district judge's former law partner, and political birds of a feather. Later, Billy Pichu became assistant district attorney after Paul Tate of Malmo resigned. There was only one assistant district attorney. Today, there are five. Quite an increase, wouldn't you say? The other attorneys in Ville Platte, except Milo and I, belong to that political faction. The two Reed attorneys, Paul Reed and Roland, were by then semi-retired and took no active interest in politics. So this left Milo and I to fight those who held the power. Jack Frugier was state senator, and he belonged to that political faction. Burton Fourier was Jack Frugier's law partner. And when Gaynor Swallow got out of law school a year later, he joined L.O. and Billy Pichu's law firm. So our stick was short, and we did not have much stroke, but we fought the good battle, occasionally striking a blow for history. After Joe V. Green became judge, I tried the first civil case in his court, and although it was close, emerged victoriously. The opposing lawyer was Seth Lewis Jr. of Opelousas, an outspoken and extremely conservative lawyer who immediately filed an appeal, vowing that he would obtain a reversal on Joe V. Green's first decision. As it turned out, and much to his chagrin and to my delight, the new Court of Appeal, speaking through Al Tate, who wrote the decision, the judgment was affirmed with the two other judges on the panel, going along with Al Tate's decision. When Seth Lewis received a copy of the decision, he went in a rage, and he took to the streets of Opelousas, cursing the Ville Platte judges, and filed for a writ of review before the state Supreme Court, and it turned the writ down, and Seth cursed some more, but his client had to come across with the cash. So score one in the win column for Judge Joe Vedrine. Later on, Seth and I became, first of all, we had many cases against each other, but socially, we became good friends. Enemies in court, but allies out of court. Seth got killed while operating the tractor many years ago, and his law partner was John Shaw, another good friend of mine who became federal judge and is now also deceased. He was the last of the good federal judges. Well, that is, he and Judge Hunter of Lake Charles. Now, they're both no longer living. Now, we are plagued with that black-robed despot in Lafayette who has succeeded in demolishing the public school system in Ville Platte. Not only did I have the first civil case before Judge George V. Green, I had the first criminal jury case, which I will now relate to you listeners in some detail. This was in 1960, and there was no such thing as an injured defender board. There was no program. When a case presented itself and the accused could not afford an attorney, the judge simply exercised his discretion and appointed one. It came to pass that Dr. R.E. Dupre's camp, just off the Chico Park Road, was burglarized. This was a very nice camp and had been built by Mr. Ketterham, who owned the canning plant in Ville Platte, and Dr. Dupre had bought it from him. A citizen by the name of Limerick Dupre, also known as Dominic Dupre, was accused of this crime. He informed the court that he had no money to hire a lawyer, and since this was a felony, he had to be represented by counsel. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I will pause for a commercial break.
A gift that lasts forever is a beautiful piece of jewelry. Morning Vague and Castile Jewelers in Opelousas has a wonderful selection of quality jewelry. Jewelry to treasure for a lifetime. Three stone jewelry, pendants, rings, and earrings, the Journey Collection, circle earrings and pendants, and more. Diamond, sapphire, topaz, color stone jewelry, green amethyst. Whatever you're looking for, you'll find it at Morning Vague and Castile Jewelers. How about a gift of time for yourself? Or that special person in your life, like watches by Fossil, Bulova, Seiko, Pulsar, Caravelle, and Citizen, in a large variety of styles to fit anyone's lifestyle. Morning Vague and Castile offers in-house jewelry repairs and a friendly professional staff. Jewelry for a special gift or for yourself, you'll find that unique piece at Morning Vague and Castile Jewelers, 942 Presswell Lane in Opelousas, or call them at 942-7060. Morning Vague and Castile Jewelers, the jewelers you've trusted since 1873.
So since Limerick had no money, Judge Vidrine appointed not only one attorney, but he appointed two of them, namely Milo Correll and myself. It seemed as though in yesteryear that Limerick had walked with the wicked and had a record sporting more than one criminal conviction in the past. Also, the evidence against him, although circumstantial, was overwhelming. And even if Limerick vigorously denied having anything to do with the burglary, it did not look too promising for him. Well, during our interview with him, he informed us that some fellows that he had squealed on resulted in their being sentenced to Angola for several years, had sent him word that if they got their hands on him, they would kill him. Therefore, it was understandable why he didn't relish the idea of being convicted and sent to his execution in Angola. Limerick's old papa and mama, Mr. and Mrs. Limerick Dupre, were also very concerned for the life and safety of Limerick, and they came to see us with sadness in their hearts and their faces. They loved their son dearly. The chief officer who had investigated the case was Audley Vidrine, who was not only the chief of police of Villeplat, but one of the Sheriff Bruce Swallow's deputies. Sheriff Bruce Swallow was Dr. Dupre's uncle, and Audley Vidrine was Dr. Dupre's first cousin, and their hatred of Limerick was intense and manifest, and they vowed to see to it that he was properly convicted and sentenced. Milo and I knew all of this, and it didn't take a nuclear scientist to figure out that it would be extremely difficult to obtain an acquittal. Well, we made careful plans and decided it would be extremely important to pick a jury that would not be either obliged and influenced by Dr. Dupre, Bruce Swallow, Audley Vidrine, or L.O. Fuselier. A rather difficult task, to say the least. We went over the jury list, and between both of us recognized many of the prospective jurors, and the ones we didn't know, we made inquiries about them. We wanted as many as we could get on the jury to be not from Villeplat, but from other wards where the influence of those I just named to you would not be so strong. On the other hand, we knew that the district attorney wanted those from Villeplat who were indebted to or belonged to their political faction. This was going to be very important because Limerick could not take the stand and testify because of his criminal convictions. We didn't want the jury to know about that. So the tedious job of selecting a jury began. Those we didn't want, we questioned severely, finding points to reject them. The prosecution did the same thing. It was interesting when Tom Hewitt, a prospective juror, came up for questioning. Tom had come to Ville Platte years ago from Oklahoma to work for Continental Oil Field at in Cape Cove. He was Max Hamlin, husband of Tony Hamlin, Parish Superintendent of Education's brother-in-law. It was obvious that the prosecution wanted him on the jury since he was from Ville Platte, but they had overlooked one important fact. Tom was a good friend of Coach Kyle Landry, Sacred Hearts football coach, and had served voluntarily as an assistant coach to Landry. They worked together at Continental Oil Company in Cape Cove. I had played on the Sacred Heart football team under Landry and Hewitt, and unknown to the district attorney, was pretty good friends with them. I wanted him on the jury. He liked me, and he called me by my nickname, Bones. And I was a very good friend of Max Hamlin, his brother-in-law. So Milo and I pretended we didn't want him, and our little plan worked to perfection. The DA accepted him, fully expecting us to reject him, and was shocked when we also accepted him. Well, that's how the game of your selection is played, ladies and gentlemen. I was learning fast. Finally, and by the hardest, a jury was selected and the trial began. The prosecution put on their case first. One by one, the district attorney called his witnesses, who put together a strong case against Limerick. The chief witness was Chief of Police, Sheriff Bruce Swallows, Deputy, and Dr. Dupre's first cousin, Audley V. Green, who was nicknamed Muldoon. And he took the stand to crucify poor Limerick. The reason we called him Muldoon, ladies and gentlemen, because at that time there was a popular television program with a detective named Muldoon, who always solved the cases and never lost a case. So Audley was nicknamed Muldoon. On cross-examination, I worked him over pretty good, being sure that I thoroughly angered him by passing him shicks and showing the jury that he had an ulterior motive for convicting our innocent, well, not too innocent client. Audley was the type of man who was thin-skinned and he took offense easily. I made him show his venomous side to the jury by peppering him with a barrage of not too relevant questions. I thought that he would come out of the witness stand and attack me, but I stood my ground and instead I did the attacking. I could see that the jury was somewhat amused and that Tom Hewitt was smiling, a good sign. But be that as it may, the evidence presented against Limerick was damaging, and the rumors around the courthouse were that the jury would nail him. Well, Milo and I knew what we had to do, and that was to make a good closing argument. When your case is weak, your closing argument better be strong. So when both sides finally rested, Milo and I burned the midnight oil, preparing our closing argument. We decided to split the task, dividing the argument between ourselves. I was to take the technical aspects to show that the state had somehow failed to meet the strict burden of proof required, and Milo was to use another tack and present a tale to the jury appealing to their humanitarian instincts. His job was to convince the jury that those guys in the Angola penitentiary were waiting for Limerick to kill him. So the next day, the bailiff brought in the jury. The arguments began. The DA went first and carefully presented the facts one by one, connecting Limerick to the burglary. And he did a rather good job. After he finished, I went first, and I began my task of showing that the evidence presented did not warrant a conviction and that the state had failed to meet the heavy burden of proof required of them in criminal cases. I then began an unmerciful assault upon Muldoon, that is Audley V. Green, and argued that he was biased and prejudiced against poor Limerick, that he worked for Sheriff Bruce Swallow, Dr. Dupre's uncle, and that he was Dr. Dupre's first cousin, that he had twisted and fabricated the evidence against Limerick, and that his testimony was not worthy of belief. Audley was sitting in the courtroom bristling with choler and fury, as I denigrated him and maligned him. After I finished my hatchet job on the Muldoon, it was Milo's turn to charm the jury, and he began to work his magic. In short, he explained to the jury that in the event they would convict Limerick, what would happen to him? And this is what he told them. They were waiting to kill him in the penitentiary. He said that a conviction and a sentence against Limerick would be a dead warrant. And he used the words of a biblical poet, and he said, "True, I am not the prophet Daniel, but the handwriting is on the wall. A sentence against Limerick, no matter how legit, will send him to the grave, and that grim, gloomy sentence of death will be on your hands." He passionately continued by picturing the following scene. He says, "I can just see it. Just before sunset, Limerick told Mom and Papa, and he pointed out to that aged and sad, somberly dressed couple in the courtroom. He says, I can see him standing at the depot in Ville Platte, waiting for the evening train and upon its arrival, that wooden coffin draped in black material containing the remains of their son being unloaded from one of the boxcars." During this drama, you could hear a pin drop in the courtroom. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the seed had been planted. The DA got up and told the jury to ignore all of that and concentrate on the facts of the case. To what extent he was successful was to be seen. The judge instructed the jury, told them to go in the jury room and deliberate and select a foreman. There were no women on the jury. Women and blacks did not serve in these free civil rights days. The jury stayed out 2 or 3 hours, and we were wondering what was going on in that jury room. Finally, they announced they were ready, and they filed in and took their seats. The judge addressed them and asked if they had reached a verdict. The foreman stood up, and believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, it was my old football coach, Tom Hewitt, who was the foreman. He answered, "Yes, sir, we did." The judge told him to hand it to the bailiff, who in turn handed it to the judge for inspection. The judge declared it was in order and gave it to the minute clerk to read aloud. We all held our breaths, looking for the worst and hoping for the best. He read aloud, "The jury finds the defendant not guilty." Pandemonium broke out in the courtroom, ladies and gentlemen. Before we could stop him, Limerick sprang from his seat, made the sign of the cross, and rushed to the jury box and shook hands with each member of the jury. The judge banged his gavel for order in the court. Limerick was a happy man. He embraced Milo and me. So Milo and I had struck a blow for liberty. Limerick walked out a free man, and Muldoon boiled with rage. Well, I hope you have enjoyed this account of another episode of my life and also of Milo and Limerick's life. Next time, ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you about a case I had when the opposing lawyer completely miscalculated the jury's mentality. I remind you that I publish a column in the Gazette, which comes out every other Thursday, and I invite you to read it. Messieurs, mesdames, merci beaucoup pour m'avoir écouté, et souhaite que vous ayez aimé cette petite histoire. Je vous raconte un autre dans 2 semaines. Same time, same station. Goodbye.
Your air conditioning and heating unit is a very large, energy-changing device. It takes fuel and changes it to heat or cool air. But when it gets old and worn out, it stops doing that. Your unit then becomes inefficient, turning that valuable unit into a large monster, just gobbling up your hard-earned money. If this happens to you, it's time to call the experts at City Refrigeration, Randy and Kevin Vaillant, 363-3844. They'll be glad to come to your home and check out your existing unit. If it needs replacing, Randy or Kevin will give you a free estimate on a new unit. City Refrigeration and Ice Company has many brands to choose from. Plus, they're an authorized dealer for American Standard, and they can service or repair any make or model of heating and cooling unit, including window units. They also service and repair all commercial equipment, including walk-ins and reach-in coolers. That's City Refrigeration and Ice Company, family-owned and family-operated.